Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And the winner of the Southern Republican Leadership Conference presidential straw poll is...
We said people have to take responsibility for getting insurance if they can afford it, or paying their own way. No more free riders.
Yes, about 1,000 Republican activists have just given an edge for 2012 to the Republican who invented Obamacare when it was known as Romneycare in Massachusetts. Let's talk about how Mitt Romney walks the line between supporting his version of the plan and opposing the president's. We'll also get into the historic conference in D.C. today, bringing dozens of world leaders together on the threat of nuclear terrorism. With me now, Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, and Michael Shearer, White House correspondent for Time. Susan, Michael, welcome back to WNYC. Hi there.
Great to be with you, Brian.
And Susan, remind us, what was this Southern Republican Leadership Conference over the weekend, and who voted in that presidential straw poll?
Well, this was a conference of, as you might guess, Republicans who tend to come from the South, which, of course, is a stronghold for the Republican Party now. And people have been paying attention to it because 4 years ago it was a kind of a proving ground for Republicans who thought they might want to run for president. Not so much so this time. Republicans now are really focused on what's going to happen in November, not 2 years from November.
And didn't Bill Frist win the straw poll four years ago?
President Frist won the straw poll 4 years ago, which may be one reason it got a little less attention this time.
Yeah, Dr. Frist. I guess they like people involved in health care at the Southern Republican Leadership Conference. And Romney was making a different joint appearance at the time, Michael, with another of his chief rivals for president, Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty. Why would they do that when party activists are sizing them up? Why would they snub them like that?
I don't think there's much upside at this point in putting themselves in the mix like that. I mean, like Susan mentioned, everybody's focused on the midterm elections. There's a lot of sort of quiet, under-the-radar work being done now. But you don't want to be too high up. You don't want to be too out in front and competing on the same level as Sarah Palin at this point in the process. I think both Pawlenty and Romney are positioning themselves as the sort of substantive core Republican with mainstream appeal candidates, not the sort of Fox News branded, part of the political circus candidate. So there was an interest in them staying out of the limelight.
Anybody know if there was a lot of discussion of Romney's role in Massachusetts in inventing a similar health care law to the one that they're probably so up in arms about with respect to the federal government?
You know, definitely one of the big problems that Romney has is explaining why his plan was not the model for the Obama plan. And the people who talk most about how it was is the White House, because they see Romney, of course, as a potential rival in 2 years, and they would love to be forcing him to explain over and over again how his plan is not really so very much like the federal plan.
Though, let me play a couple of clips. This one, again, that we started with, Mitt Romney sounding very much like President Obama with Chris Wallace recently on Fox News Sunday, at least on the very basis of the plan.
We said people have to take responsibility for getting insurance if they can afford it, or paying their own way. No more free riders.
No more free riders. In other words, the individual mandate that a lot of states are now suing Washington or getting ready to sue them for imposing. But here again is Romney from that same interview trying to articulate why he does support his own plan in Massachusetts but still opposes the president's.
And we solve this at the state level, not a federal plan, but a state plan. This is a federalist nation. States should be able to solve their own problems. We didn't raise taxes. We did not, at the same time, cut Medicare and expect our seniors to have to pay for all this. And we didn't do what President Obama is doing, which is putting controls on our system of premiums for private insurance companies.
So, Michael Shearer, does that last part, when he said putting a system of controls for premiums on the insurance company, does that mean that Romney would leave in place denials for pre-existing conditions and annual and lifetime coverage caps for people who are insured and let the market sort that out? Or do you think he meant something else there?
I, it's a very fine line he's walking. I mean, there's actually Republican consensus over pre-existing conditions, even in the House of Representatives, which, you know, no Republican voted for the plan. So I doubt he would go out that far and say, look, I want, you know, sick people not to be able to get insurance. The issue here with Romney is that he's on a book tour where the stated intent is to reintroduce himself as sort of the policy wonk who can solve problems, which is actually very close to who he actually is. The problem is he's coming out of 2008 with a lot of baggage, where he ran as somebody he really wasn't. He tried to run as sort of this core social conservative, true red-blooded Republican, and the Republican Party for the most part didn't really buy it. And the problem he has now is he's again having to walk this line where he, you know, the question you that comes to your mind as you listen to these clips is, does Mitt Romney actually believe what he's saying here? Does he actually believe that the Obama health care plan is that horrible on these stated objections that it's, you know, the federal plan instead of a state plan and things like that? And so it's really
that is the core objection, right? I mean, if you're really going to reduce it down, it's a pretty good plan at the federal level. I thought of it myself, really, but it's the state's right and it's not the federal government's right to impose it. Is that
right?
It?
And then he uses lots of adjectives to sort of embellish that objection. I mean, it's like, you know, it's a horrible thing. I mean, he'll make it sound like he is the fiercest opponent of health care just by the adjectives and adverbs he puts around his description of the plan. And mm-hmm. and in substance, he's not that far away from Obama in terms of how he would approach solving this problem.
And I guess, Susan, on that particular issue of what he was referring to with respect to the insurance companies and controlling premiums, I guess he means the part of the health reform plan that in some instances requires insurance companies to spend a certain amount of what they take in on premiums on actual benefits.
I think without talking to Governor Romney, it's hard to know exactly what he meant by that phrase, actually. I mean, he's trying to portray his plan as different in as many ways as possible from the Obama plan that's now been passed. His problem is that the core of both plans is this individual mandate that requires everyone to have insurance. And on that, the two plans are, you know, basically identical. And Massachusetts was a testing ground to see if that could work. So he's got a situation where when I interviewed him about 6 weeks ago, he called the Massachusetts plan one of his big achievements as governor, while then going on to explain how it's not at all a model for the federal government.
And there are other things in the book that make it sound also very similar, where he says he believes that there should be an individual mandate, albeit at the state level, and that there should be subsidies, government subsidies, mm-hmm. I guess, right. In Massachusetts, state government subsidies for people who can't afford the premiums on their own.
Well, you can't do individual mandates unless you provide subsidies for lower income people. That's just a fact of life. But to get back to something Michael was saying, if Romney's biggest problem last time was his lack of a sense of authenticity, this whole discussion just feeds that once again. Is what does he believe? Who is he really? Can you trust what he says? I think that's really one of Romney's biggest problems as he heads into this presidential campaign.
All right, I want to move on to the nuclear terrorism summit in Washington today. And let me play a clip of President Obama from over the weekend talking about what a serious issue this is.
The single biggest threat to U.S. security, both short-term, medium-term, and long-term, would be the possibility of a terrorist organization obtaining a nuclear weapon. This is something that could change the security landscape in this country and around the world for years to come.
So, Michael Shearer, Time Magazine White House correspondent, who's coming to the summit in Washington today? Somebody told me it's the biggest gathering of actual heads of state since FDR convened one once upon a time.
Yeah, and FDR wasn't actually even able to attend that event because he died a couple weeks earlier. But yeah, it's a huge show of force for the president, who, you know, the U.S. generally goes overseas to these events. They don't host them. They usually don't host them in Washington, D.C. when they do have 40-some, or it's almost 40 heads of state coming from around the world. You know, this is another example of Obama's foreign policy approach, which is that, you know, he's committed to the idea of diplomatic conversation and big public shows, and he's not afraid of the fact that at the end of the day, there's not going to be much binding coming out of it. I mean, there's a tradition of foreign policy where you don't go into one of these big meetings unless you know you're going to have a very big deliverable at the end. The White House is comfortable with the idea that they're going to come out of this meeting with a communique. It's not it's political communique. It's not legally binding communique. And that they will have raised the issue not only in the U.S. but around the world and got these countries thinking about it and discussing it in the hopes that at some point down the road, that they can make real progress.
And to do what, Susan? Because everybody's against nuclear terrorism, right? I mean, Iran's against nuclear terrorism. We're not talking about states having nuclear material or building nuclear weapons. We're talking about non-state terrorists here. Is anybody for that?
Well, I would think only perhaps some terrorist groups would be for that. But the issue is the kind of controls that countries that are pursuing nuclear programs have on the nuclear material that you could use to make a terrorist bomb or that a terrorist group might obtain and use. And it's an issue that, President Obama didn't come to office with a long history on issues of national security and foreign policy, but this is one that he did work on as a senator with Senator Lugar from Indiana, for whom this has been a cause of decades, trying to control these loose nukes and prevent them from falling into the hands of non-state actors who might actually be willing to use them.
Is it a coincidence that this comes just days after the president's new nuclear weapons policy announcement and the treaty signing with Russia, Michael?
No. The event was obviously scheduled months and months and months ago, but the nuclear posture review, I think, was also timed to come out right before this. And the START treaty, they wanted wrapped up initially before the end of last year. It was delayed a number of months. I think they were very happy to get it out of the way to show that the U.S. is really, putting its money where its mouth is.
I'm just curious, before you both go, I asked the chief of naval operations on this show last week, what's a scenario under which the United States might ever use a nuclear weapon? Because, while Republicans were criticizing Obama for being too soft last week with the new nuclear strategy, some people were saying, he really did not make it as clear to the world as he might have that the United States is just not going to use a nuclear weapon, maybe against anybody. Is there any scenario left on the table after the Cold War or after the era of, mass troop movements like in World War II? They say we used it to save so many thousands of troops from getting killed in battle. Is there any scenario that they're willing to acknowledge under which the United States sees itself using a nuclear weapon today?
Yes, I think there are. You heard, in fact, Secretary Gates and Secretary Clinton talking about that on some of the Sunday shows yesterday, that the United States would reserve the right to use nuclear weapons if nuclear weapons were used on the United States, and also if there were a biological attack. Secretary Clinton, in one show left, said that would certainly mean that all bets were off on what the U.S. response was. This administration has not ruled out the use of nuclear weapons in all situations.
But as what? To accomplish what? I mean, if you can go there one step further, to accomplish what? Even if we are attacked with a nuclear or biological weapon, what do we get strategically? Is it just retribution, but killing mass numbers of civilians in return?
I mean, go
ahead, Michael.
Ever since the end of the Cold War, nuclear weapons have been really talked about in terms of deterrence, and I think that's still the case. I mean, the debate here is whether you have a better deterrent by reserving the right of a first strike or reserving the right of using it in response to a biological, not a nuclear attack, or whether you have a better deterrent if whether it's better for diplomatic reasons to give up those publicly and then work towards eliminating the number of nuclear weapons, the number of states with nuclear weapons. But I don't think there's a realistic possibility, and I don't think there's been one for many, many years since the end of the Cold War of this actually being used. The fact is that our conventional weapons are so good at this point and getting so much better that there are very few targets that would require a nuclear weapon. So then what you're talking about is this sort of strategic deterrence. If bad acting state X uses a really nasty weapon and kills lots of civilians, should we at least have outstanding the threat of killing a lot of their civilians
as right.
well?
Michael Shearer, White House correspondent for Time, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, did you know that water, not the water you buy in a bottle in the grocery store, but the water that comes out of your tap at home in New York City might cost nearly 13% more. We'll talk to the commissioner in charge of that in a minute.